Welcome to this Today's Football Times podcast brought to you by Manscaped. Get 20% off Manscaped products when you use code TFT20.
Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present, with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to Today's Football Times with me, Aidan Williams. We're delving into the troubled relationship today between football and the betting industry, plus a little bit on Chelsea, Wrexham and more besides. As ever, I've got some great guests to help me discuss it all. Firstly, we've got Matthew Gibbs joining us again today. Another meaty subject for us to get into, Matthew.
Hi, thanks for having me back on. Yeah, looking forward to it. It's quite a troubling topic, but I think it should be an interesting discussion.
Excellent. We've also got Stephen Bell with us. Stephen, author supreme. How are you doing today, Stephen?
I'm great, Aidan. Thank you. Yeah, thanks for inviting me onto this. As someone who admittedly likes a little dabble, all in very healthy contexts, of course. I can kind of contribute a little bit, I think, to how I've seen it get out of hand over the last few years. And I think we can all agree it has.
Indeed, so absolutely. And also bringing us a taste of Wrexham style Hollywood glamour. Couldn't get Ryan Reynolds on, but we've got the next best thing. James Kelly, how are you doing this evening?
I'm all right, thanks, Aidan. And it's a good job this is a podcast, because I think in the looks department, I'm not quite up to Ryan Reynolds' standard.
Well, that's the beauty of the pod. Nobody needs to know the truth. Okay, then. Well, let's get stuck into the betting issues then. Football today is a real focal point for gambling due to a number of factors. Obviously, the demographics of the fan base, its general global popularity, the sheer number of possibilities for betting within a game. And goal scorers are the obvious ones, but corners, throw-ins, cards and all the rest. Almost every element of the game can be turned into a way for people to be enticed into gambling, and more often than not, on losing their money. Before we get into the wider issues, though, obviously we've seen the Kieran Trippier case in the news recently. Despite some of the initial reports, his lump on it, if you want, comment, I guess, is rather damning, given the current rules anyway, as he's given what they might term as insider information. But the wider point to me, I think, on this is that it's ostensibly ludicrous that someone can't discuss a career move with friends or family, for instance, for fear of falling foul of betting rules. It's a betting market that the betting companies themselves, the betting representative anyway, recently claimed it didn't even make any money out of that particular market. It's just a bit of fun. Really, it serves, though, to get people onto the betting apps where they're more likely to then place other bets too. Matthew, given that context, and the fact that Trippier was talking to friends about an upcoming career move and life move, is Trippier's ban fair?
No, in my opinion, it's a bit of a ridiculous decision. Like I know you say, like, you referenced the WhatsApp messages, and yes, he said, yeah, lump on it. But I wouldn't really say that's encouraging your mates to place a bet. It's more just sort of just agreeing, I guess. I didn't get much encouragement from it. And it's like you say, this is his job. Is he not supposed to talk about his job, about his career aspirations, about his future career plans with his friends, with his family? Maybe considering what we know about the wider betting industry and football's relationship with it, maybe there should have been a bit more safety on his side, a bit more secrecy. This is happening, but don't tell anybody. But to call it insider knowledge just feels a bit a wild exaggeration, and kind of shows how much football is in the pocket of betting. And then to make a bit of a sidestep maybe, but when you compare his ban, which was 10 games, compare it to other bans that have been given to footballers recently, like Edison Cavani, who was banned for 3 games for using a racist language. The FA has deemed that racist, and yet he was only banned for 3 games and Trippier for 10. It doesn't... I'm not sure what the right word is, but there's no equality. There's no... the comparison is just way off for me, and just... It's basically saying that breaking betting laws is more serious offence than racist behaviour, which is ludicrous.
And hugely so, I guess, with what they're saying, isn't it? Several times the magnitude.
There's no comparison.
If such betting markets make no money. It was somebody who was on the Guardian podcast I heard recently, I think, or was referenced on the Guardian podcast, talking about how this particular market is just for fun, doesn't make any money. Why do they have this market at all? I mean, it was Jonathan Wilson, I think, who said, the idea that a betting company can have a market that stops me having a conversation with my mates is ludicrous. I guess the same could apply to managerial sackings as well as transfers. Stephen, I mean, you say you like a dabble occasionally, but what are your thoughts on these particular betting markets that are not betting on the actual game?
I just don't think they should exist at all. The slogan that these betting firms use now, or like to use, is when the fun stops, stop. But what fun is anybody getting out of gambling on when a man's going to lose his job, or which man's going to lose his job next, or in Kieran Trippier's case, where a man's going to make his next career move? I don't think the betting companies have termed that as it's just a bit of fun, this market, but I'm failing to see that personally. I can see why betting on your favourite player to score a goal in a game that you're watching live, I can see why that might add a little bit of fun to it. I think the word fun is right there, as long as it's in the right context. The betting's not getting out of hand. I've got absolutely no issue with that, but I just think that technology has enabled through apps being readily available at the user's fingertips, and as you say, just this plethora of markets that are available to people, it's encouraging insider info. It really is. Anybody is only going on their markets if they feel they know something. It might just be something that they've read in the paper. It might be a gut feeling that they've got themselves. It might be that they've heard something on some grapevine, you know, through WhatsApp and groups. It only takes a couple of WhatsApp messages forwarded onto the right or wrong WhatsApp groups, and then on again, for these things to leak out, and then people are going to go onto these markets and have a bet. I don't see how anybody in that stream can be the ones who are being regarded as doing anything wrong. For me, the betting companies kind of deserve all they get from that point of view if they get stung in these markets. I've got no sympathy with them whatsoever.
And that's an interesting point on that. I'm coming to you, James, on this, because it's the betting markets who are the only ones who can get stung in this way. But in this case, the FA are bending over backwards to protect the betting company by obviously applying this ban while having the rule in the first place as well. Am I alone in thinking it just looks the wrong way around? It's, you know, the betting industry has so many advantages in betting, obviously. Is it really the FA's responsibility to look after the bookies here?
I don't think so, Aidan, to be honest with you. I think this is something I'm sure we'll discuss as we talk more broadly about betting and football. But I think regulation really is the key sort of phrase here. And I feel like for the FA to become involved in this, it's almost as if there's a double standard, and there's kind of vested interests here within the betting companies. And I mean, that might sound like a bit of a conspiracy, but you have to look at it and say realistically, I would agree with the others that I think as a market, this is extremely flawed, and I don't think it should exist. But I think the main issue for me personally is if you look at, with regards to Kieran Trippier, the actual money that was placed on these bets, it's not like some sort of Singapore or Southeast Asian betting syndicate that's gone and, you know, placed 10,000-15,000 on a game in the sort of eighth tier to be fixed or something. This is a couple of hundred pounds here and there has been squandered. And yeah, okay, the betting companies have lost a little bit. But I think that, as you say, they've been stung. And I think ultimately, betting companies are set up in the way, like any business, obviously, they don't want to lose money. But I feel like with betting companies, it's almost like when they do get one done over, they react almost like a sort of child throwing their toys out of the pram. And I think to get the FA involved in this, when there's so many other issues, I mean, obviously you've seen in the past couple of days, there's several sort of racist incidents that have come out and players speaking out about, you know, abuse they're receiving on social media. You've seen other situations arise with sort of few players in academies speaking out about sort of the aftercare system there. I feel like there's far more pressing issues for the FA to sort out rather than a couple of people picking up on a WhatsApp message and placing, as I say, a very limited sum of money when you consider how much money there is in football on one transfer taking place.
Okay, well, let's get into the wider issues on it all then as well. So, I mean, gambling advertising is a place to start. It's effectively become normalised, I guess. Advertising portrays betting as glamorous fun and a harmless activity. Most significantly, I guess, it's a normal everyday activity that watching football, in their view, is less fun without. It's portrayed as something you just do as part of the normal experience of watching football. I guess the influence this has had, Matthew, along with easy access to betting apps and so on gambling activity. Overall, this must be phenomenal influence it's having.
Yeah, it's really dangerous. And I think like you say, and I think Steve mentioned before, but I think the internet has been the worst thing to happen for the gambling and the betting industry, where it's instantaneous. You can now bet on, you can bet on something that happens on the other side of the world and then come back here and bet on the big game here. And you mentioned the Guardian pod, but I know they did an interview with, I can't remember his name, but he's an individual from the Big Step charity, which is a charity built to help assist gambling addiction and help with recovery. And he gave some lived experience and talked about his experience with gambling and how he was so addicted that his dad was dying in hospital and he was on his phone, on his app, like on the chat roulettes in I think it was something like in an Asian country like Singapore or something. Really harrowing, stories, and really sort of really hammers home how it can affect you. And it feels like something that it can really easily get on top of you. You can go from one bet to, you know, all of a sudden you're thousands and thousands of pounds in debt. And it's really dangerous and really encouraged by these adverts, which I was just reading, like, it's having a really big impact on children as well. Like, the younger generations are now growing up seeing these adverts and, like you say, being told that this is normal. This is a normal part of like a football match day, encouraging them so they can access even before they get to the age of 18, because it's not like these sites are regulated in any way. It's incredibly dangerous, I think.
And as you say, their betting itself is all pervasive, the access to it on the internet, apps and all of that. It's hard to extricate yourself as an organisation from it. And the FA, a short while ago, they severed their direct ties with betting firms, only for it to then come to light that via a third party, the broadcast rights to the FA Cup matches, I don't think this was this season, but I think recently, they've been sold to betting companies. So equally, betting companies are able to broadcast other live football during the 3 p.m. Saturday blackout, so long as you've got a betting account with them and are willing to be enticed into a bet. Stephen, is there a bit of a moral issue here of matches being broadcast on betting apps as a way that's drawing people in?
Well, the question answers itself, I think. You've got games that would otherwise be pay-to-view, be it through a subscription or whatever it might be, that are then advertised as free-to-view if you have a bet on it. I mean, it's obvious that there's a conflict of interest there for me, but as usual with these things, money speaks and conflicts of interest seem to get swept under the carpet when it's convenient for people to line the pockets. And I genuinely think that's what's going off with this. The adverts are so targeted, so gratuitous, and don't get me wrong, from a marketing point of view, who could ask for a better situation than you've got this advertising space, you've got this advertising time right in the middle of the live event that your target market is tuning into. It's absolutely built for efficiency and making people pick the phones up. They don't, you know, they can be sat watching the game in the comfort of their own home. All they have to do is pick the phone up and take advantage of whatever offer, in inverted commas, is Ray Winston happens to be telling them they should take advantage of. And, you know, obviously only going back 15, 20 a year, that wouldn't have been available. That customer would have had to go to his local bookmakers to place a bet. He would have had no idea about any kind of in-play offers. And I think that the in-play offers and the instantaneous nature of having the app on your phone, I just think that's where it's got a little bit sinister, I think is the word I want to use, the way that it's targeted. And you're not safe in the comfort of your own home almost, I think is the dangerous part of it.
Some key football media outlets, they're also very tied to betting. So the TV stations, obviously newspapers, podcasts, but also the championship or the football league, I guess, itself, sponsored by Skybet, makes it hard for any club who didn't wish to get into bed with the bookies to avoid it. The bombardment of the messages is kind of unavoidable to the punters as well. So the relationship with betting has become so all-encompassing, with the game actively chasing this money as well. So shirt sponsorship, stadium naming rights, official gambling partners. Recent stat for you. So of the 44 Premier League and Championship clubs, only 8 don't have an official gambling partner. This season, 8 of the 20 Premier League teams have a betting company as their shirt sponsor, which is actually slightly down on last year. But it's by far the most popular industry for shirt sponsors to come from. So is it possible then, James, for clubs to actually avoid this if they really wanted to make a stand? Luton Town, I guess, one example from lower down that come to mind of actively shying away from gambling money. But that's got to be very hard for clubs. I mean, maybe less so at the top level, but at the lower levels, it must be incredibly hard to get away from this betting influence if you chose to.
Yeah, I think this is the thing. I mean, I think the other guys have really hit the nail on the head that it's become so normalised and it is just so constant that, you know, even if you're watching a football match on telly and you don't watch the adverts, you go and make a cup of tea or, you know, go on Twitter for 5 minutes, the chances that you get, you know, Ray Winston's head popping up or some other betting company appear on your timeline is pretty likely. And I feel like it's just so shoved down our throats, really, that, you know, it gets to the stage where if you're watching a game on Sky and it's, you know, you have sort of the introduction and the teams read out, and then you have, what, like a 30-second advert for, you know, just reminding you if you haven't quite sort of got the message that you can bet on this game and that you can sort of, you know, decide if you want to work out how many corners there's going to be. I mean, for me, the prospect of watching a football match and hoping for there to be a certain number of corners is nonsensical. You know, I think it just, if you have to bet on a game of football to enjoy it, then you should go and watch something else. But I think certainly in the lower leagues, I feel like you say, with the whole Skybet sponsorship of the Football League, I think it really is something whereby, I think the issue as well is that a lot of these clubs, as we've seen with the COVID pandemic, they don't have very much money. And it gets to the stage where you've got that fine line where it's the ethical issues of what it is sponsoring you versus needing money to survive as a club. And obviously these clubs don't solely exist off, you know, sponsorship from betting companies. But I feel like it's got to the stage now where it has become a lot, very large part of football. And I think that is a very dangerous sort of aspect we've got to.
I mean, yeah, it's very much so. I mean, at the top level as well, then, Matthew, none of the so-called Big Six have a betting shirt sponsor. And I guess this may indicate the sort of different financial reality that these clubs exist in. So they've got more financial options and potentially then the loss of sponsorship revenue and choosing someone else, whether that's for a moral stand or just a bigger offer. The betting money on offer is... you know, they can replace it more easily, whereas for others, the money that is on offer is beyond what they could earn from others, isn't it?
It's true, but I do think they're just maybe a little bit more canny about it. I know I read Tottenham Hotspur, for example, betting partners are now coming up with like more and more inventive ways of entice people to come to them. So I think if you go to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium and you connect on your phone and you try to access the William Hill site, you can't. It's blocked because they have a partnership with Ladbrokes. So I think while they're not as entirely dependent on the betting money, so they don't need to have the big betting companies on the front of their shirts, they still have the official sponsors. I know I've seen recently Liverpool players advertised with, I think it was Bet365, I can't remember one of them. There's so many of the betting companies, but they still do that. And I think it's really concerning. It's a bit says a lot about clubs lower down. I know Luton, I know Tranmere, like Tranmere, I think were very, very vocal about they were not going to get involved with betting companies at all, which is really admirable, I think. Especially considering that it's like James said, it's so pervasive, and it's so, if you don't take this money, then what other options do you have? Because the money in football has exploded to the point where, while there are other options, there are other, you know, sponsorship options, it's going to be a lot less than what betting companies can offer, which is just equally problematic, I think.
In this current, I mean, COVID got a mention just earlier. So in this current situation, Stephen, is football's relationship with betting even more problematic? I mean, people are being furloughed. Maybe this was more last year than now, perhaps, but people are being furloughed from their jobs, coupled with the fact that more football is available to watch than ever, or with the endless bombardment of advertising that we talked about. Is that making a more toxic mix, if that's even possible?
It is, but I think that's where I think a lot of it is targeted and, as I've used the word before, sinister. I think that was almost an accidental cocktail that got mixed up. People, the TV companies and the Premier League were adamant that they wanted to entertain people at a cost that were at home in lockdown and have more games on every day and different times. And you know, you provide that form of entertainment and make sure that your football seemed to be going ahead as normal, as one of the few industries that could go ahead as normal, was serving its purpose to the fans that even couldn't go to the stadium, and it was still entertaining them by having so many live games. But that naturally brought about this, the betting scenario, and unfortunately a lot of the demographics that are targeted by the betting industry are the same people who were sat at home watching football because they've been told by the government they can't go to work. You know, I do have some sympathy there, not with the betting firms. I think just with, certainly with the punters who have fallen into the trap, if you like. I think that's just been a tragic consequence of the unforeseen circumstances that we found ourselves in. I think with the benefit of hindsight, something would have been done in advance. I'd like to think that, although I'm probably being naive. I don't think it probably would have been done. It's probably people have made some money out of the fact. I mean, as you've just been discussing, guys, the sponsorship money from the betting companies is only coming from one place, and I just think that's so blatant. All that money is only coming out of the pockets of the working class people who they're targeting to take the money out of them pockets. And yeah, I do think eventually something's going to have to be done. I almost think that the world has overtaken. I think there's a place in the world for gambling sites and having a bet on football. I don't think there's any problem with that, as long as it's all regulated and done in a sensible manner. I just think that the technology has overtaken the moral standpoint of it, and the technology has enabled the betting companies to be so profitable at the expense of the punter that it's gotten away from what it was originally supposed to be, I think, and that's what needs reining in, I think.
Well, we'll come on to the what can change and what should change shortly, but I mean, I guess if football must continue to have such sponsorship, James, assuming they still want the bookies' money, should they accept a share of the responsibility for trying to make it a safer environment, or perhaps a more supportive one for young people in particular, or problem gamblers, as we mentioned? And we've already said about young kids that the exposure to the betting message must be harmful to their general perception of sport and football specifically, because it's just everywhere. The football equals betting in so many people's minds. Should football therefore have more responsibility if they continue to court this money?
I think partly, yeah. I think there is an issue, I would say, with regards to, I think shirt sponsorship is slightly different. I feel like, you know, obviously, as you mentioned, there are so many teams in the Premier League and in the EFL that have betting companies as a shirt sponsor, but I'm not quite sure how directly that impacts, in the sense of, you know, some of these companies that I see sponsoring shirts. I remember, I think it was Bolton and Wigan used to, it was like 188 bet or something. Obviously you've got like Wolves, I think is Man Bet X. Like, I've never heard of anybody using these sorts of companies. So I'm not really sure if the actual shirt sponsorship has that much of an impact, in the same way that you go back sort of 20, 25 years, a lot of football shirts were sponsored by beer companies and by various forms of alcohol. You obviously, you know, as a Newcastle fan, you'll know, Aidan, you know, Nuki Brown on a Newcastle shirt is the iconic sponsor, much in the same way.
It was almost part of the kit, wasn't it? Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, in the same way that a Wrexham shirt with Wrexham lager on is what Wrexham fans look for. We released a sort of pre-season top a few years ago with that sponsor on, which sold out. You look at Holston at Spurs is another one that I can think of off the top of my head. And obviously we didn't have a sort of generation of alcoholics. I think the issue is far more the first of all, the accessibility, as we've been discussing. And I think also the fact that there is just so much constant advertising in terms of actually on the TV, because now obviously people are watching football so much on the telly as opposed to, as I say, 20, 25 years ago. And the fact that this is coupled with all these sponsorships saying, I mean, I can't remember the last time I watched a football match on the TV and there was an adverts break that didn't have some form of incitement to make you try and bet. And I think that's what needs to be targeted. I think in terms of a moral obligation, I think the broadcasters need to do more personally, because I feel like you look at the likes of Sky and BT and it's their platform that's ultimately being used to get these adverts out there, which, as I say, I think that is the issue more than the actual shirt sponsorships.
Okay, so if we move on to what could or should change, there are proposals at the moment for a ban on what's called whistle-to-whistle advertising. So that's a self-imposed and self-regulated betting industry idea. So the betting company's names would still be seen, obviously, repeatedly, even without Ray Winston's face popping up, as we say, on our TV at halftime. But they wouldn't be able to directly have those adverts during the game. They'd just have the shirt sponsorships, the billboards, and so on. They're very prominent during broadcasts, of course. There's some research from Goldsmiths University that I read recently. So last year they found that gambling logos or branding were on screen for between 71% and 89% of the match of the day actual match action on the programmes, even though the BBC doesn't carry actual advertising. Matthew, without other fundamental changes, is such an idea simply paying lip service?
Yeah, maybe. And I just think there needs to be, yeah, like, I agree with everything with what James and Stephen said, that there needs to be like a shift in perception. Because I think there's a lot of people still see betting as a way to make a quick buck. I think we must have all known people from when we were younger or know now. So we know someone who's won 20 grand or something on a bet. I think the perception of it's a quick way to make money needs to be changed. I also think the infrastructure's to help people, like to help gambling addiction, because I think one of the stats I read that was kind of scary was that I think there's about 300,000 addicts in Britain. Only 3% of those actually get the help that they need. So not only does there need to be a change in perception of how we see gambling and how, you know, more people need to be aware of the dangerous effects it can have on people, there also needs to be more in the way of help, because it's one of those ones that's quite misunderstood. A lot of the stuff I was reading today compares, like the sensation in your head of when you place a bet is similar to taking drugs, which felt weird, but it's what I read today. And more people need to be aware, and more infrastructure needs to be in place to help those who have been really badly affected by it.
What about actual changes then, Stephen? What kind of things do you think the game could do, or the government perhaps? Without an all-out ban, I guess along the lines of what came in on tobacco advertising in the past, is it going to be impossible to end this relationship?
It's certainly not impossible. The government has done things in the past. I know with your... there's a turn of phrase for them, but you know the touchscreen machines within betting shops, they had a major clampdown on them. That went from being sort of unlimited to, I think it came down, this is off the top of my head, but I think it might have been something like £2 or the maximum value of any stake on any one press, if that's the right terminology, which was huge in terms of sort of altering the revenue that they were creating for the bookmakers. And you know, there's obviously tax implications, and that's where the government has to weigh up what they want to do and where its morals are against its own income. But as you say, they've had the same moral judgment to make with the tobacco industry, with the alcohol industry, in terms of how much they encourage the sales of them things, where they, what tax brackets to put them in. I know it's probably only maybe 20 years ago, I think, that there used to be a tax on betting as well, actually, at the point of sale. The punter would have to pay an extra certain percentage on every bet. That was a direct tax. They sort of got rid of that, which I suppose encourages the betting, but it's also in favour of the punter. There's a lot of things to be taken into account with it, but I do think football in particular is the bit where it's just gone beyond the pale, beyond the moral standpoint in terms of how much it's rammed down your throat. And I think that's where the betting companies, football, the government all need to come together. And if it's getting rid of these ludicrous markets that make the apps so huge, you know, somebody who has got that addiction, and Matthew's right, it's serotonin that's released when you have a bet, just like any other addiction that you might have. It's not the actual thing that you're doing that's addictive, it's the release of serotonin and how much in one person for any one activity that might be. And a lot of people, it's gambling that releases that. And I just think that at this point, we feel like maybe it's COVID and lockdown and the things that we've discussed that's brought it under the microscope so much. Now seems to be the perfect time where these companies can get together. And if it is getting rid of some of these, the plethora of markets, you know, somebody who has got that problem can literally spend a whole day just looking through the markets available on one app, let alone the dozens that are available. It just seems like it's reached a point where it's endless. And to somebody who's got that problem, you know, an heroin addict runs out of money, you might argue, or, you know, he can get locked in his room to go cold turkey, as the films portray it. It just feels like for people with a gambling problem, there is no way at the minute of them to escape it. And I think that's where they need to come together and just curb it a little bit.
It's coming to you then, James. Do you think, does the football industry too easily forget that the betting industry needs football more than football needs the betting industry, perhaps? I mean, betting would be nothing without an activity to bet on, whereas football can and does get money from all sorts of revenue streams. Is that something that's too easily forgotten? And is football just simply addicted to, and the irony, of course, is it addicted to the betting money?
I think it's just addicted to money in general, really. I think any way that football can, you know, bring in a little bit more cash, it's going to do that. And it sounds horrendous, but I feel like it's got to the stage where whatever cost that is, the sort of governing authorities are not really too fussed. I mean, the fact that when you go on a betting app, as Stephen was saying, you know, the possibilities are endless, not just in terms of obviously things you can bet on, but the levels that you can go to are just ridiculous. I mean, I had a very good mate at uni who he wasn't addicted to betting, but he liked to flutter sort of every couple of days. And he'd do accumulators that would have like the Bolivian second division in them. And I mean, you know, I can't even tell you who plays in the Bolivian second division, let alone, you know, the games that are going on and who's doing well and who isn't. And I think when it gets to the level that you can bet on that, I think it's just the joke, really. And I think to answer your question with regards to, you know, does the betting industry need football more than football needs the betting industry? Absolutely, because if football, you know, there was a blanket ban, let's just say hypothetically, on betting on football, the betting industry would obviously have horse racing. There's lots of other things that bets could be placed on. But I feel like football doesn't need the betting industry to survive. And I think it's driven really by greed more than anything, unfortunately.
Indeed so. And doesn't that sum up top-flight football or much of high-level football around this country and Europe at the moment? But Let's move on anyway from this topic onto some actual football, which would be a nice refreshing change. We've seen a bit of a change of the guard at Chelsea recently with Frank Lampard being given the axe and Thomas Tuchel coming in to replace him. I guess the question here, Matthew, was this change inevitable given that Chelsea are clearly at risk of missing out on a Champions League place currently? And as a follow-up, I guess, do you think Lampard should never have really been given such an opportunity in the first place, given his background of coaching?
Yeah, I think that's exactly my point. I think he's an immensely privileged individual in terms of connections, in terms of, you know, his background, in terms of how he got the Derby job in the first place. Like, Harry Redknapp was very vocal about, you know, the amount of calls that he put into Mel Morris to get him that position, and he didn't exactly pull up any trees at Derby. He did all right. Like, you can see he's a competent enough manager, but he didn't do enough with Derby to that warrant getting this, you know, his dream job. I think it's a job that came too early for him. Like, I don't necessarily think let's rephrase that. I think he has a future in managing. Like, he has some interesting ideas and he's not incapable. I just think it came too early for him. And I think, it was too big a job for his capabilities, and he was, I think, well, if you read everything you read, like from The Athletic and other places talking about behind the scenes, he didn't really have a clue how to do the, like, you know, organised attacking, and apparently his tactics were quite confused to follow at times. But I think it's a strange situation as well, because I think the situation wasn't helpful to him. I think Chelsea signed, I think they spent, what, $250 million in the summer signing new players. They signed Timo Werner, they signed Kai Havertz, really exciting young players. But kind of need to remember, we're living through a pandemic, and footballers are human as well. They are affected just as we are. Kai Havertz is a 19-year-old kid who came over from Germany, living in a new city, has not been able to explore that city. All he's been able to do is just, you know, go to work, go to training, and then go back home. And I assume he's living on his own, or unless he's living with other people. It's a really difficult situation. And then he actually gets COVID. And by all accounts, look at his face, how gaunt he is at times. Like, he was really badly affected by it. I just think there was maybe Lampard could have been cut a bit of slack in that regard. Like, getting all these players to settle in this particular time is a difficult task. But like you say, he should never have been in the position in the first place. The job was way too big for him.
Well, I guess that's the theme, isn't it? There's a bit of a current trend over the last few years anyway of star players getting big jobs at top clubs, not just in this country. You know, you can look at Juventus as well. I guess the Guardiola factor, isn't it, of trying to replicate the success he's had. Anyway, Stephen, coming to you, is this, I don't know how to phrase this really, but is this sort of celebrity culture writ large in football, or is it just blindness to, you know, wanting to give the job to a club legend and earn a bit of popularity for the ownership? Or what do you think's behind that?
I do think it's with good intentions. Again, maybe I'm being a bit naive there, but I do. I think the owners know that the fans would love to see that. I'm a United fan. I loved initially the idea of Solskjaer coming in. That was more to do with the fact they were following Louis van Gaal and Jose Mourinho than anything else, I think. And it was just something to get United back to some form of status quo, or status quo as I knew them anyway. And despite some troubling times under Solskjaer, it appears that it's coming good, but these things can change so quickly. You know, 2 months ago, I would have sworn blind that Solskjaer would be out before Lampard and that Chelsea would finish higher in the league than United. And the role reversal in form of the clubs and therefore the managers and the pedestal that Solskjaer has now been held upon is the one that Lampard will be held upon, it seems, only 2 or 3 months ago. And that's how quickly these things can change. I do think it came too quick for Lampard. I don't think that should put others off. You know, I know this topic's main topic of this pod's been about gambling, so I don't want to use the term, but what odds are we having on Gerrard being the next Liverpool manager? I reckon they'd be pretty short. And that's going to be a similar theme, as you've said, going forward. If Rangers go ahead and win the Scottish Championship, then you'd like to think he's got a little bit more behind him than Lampard had getting the Chelsea job, or that Solskjaer had getting the United job. But again, it's the same sort of thing. And what you don't want to see, even as a fan of an opposing club, you don't want to see that legendary player's reputation at a club tarnished by a very brief and unsuccessful managerial spell, because it's no shame in getting the boot from one of these big clubs. They're a revolving door, we all know that. And I do think it feels like a fairy tale and quickly turns into a nightmare.
Well, yes, I mean, we discussed Solskjaer only a couple of months back, didn't we, on a pod that'll probably be coming out soon. It'll make our comments seem a little dated, slating what he was achieving there and how he really ought to be gone. I guess things have changed there and we'll look a bit foolish, but never mind. That won't be the first time, I suppose. But I mean, coming to you, James, Stephen's there saying it shouldn't harm coach's reputation to be booted out by one of the big clubs, especially Chelsea, I guess, because it's a revolving door. Is it, conversely though, managers who sort of do cut their teeth and prove themselves at a lower level, and possibly Gerrard is an example of this, and Lampard did try, I guess, in a year at Derby, but are these other managers getting overlooked for star quality? So, you know, people like Graham Potter and Eddie Howe, yes, of course, they've managed in the Premier League, but will they ever get considered for the very top jobs? Whereas somebody like Lampard does get that offer.
I think absolutely, yeah. I mean, the others have talked about, obviously, Lampard's reputation and the status that he held at Chelsea. I mean, I'd pose it to you, if this was Gary Rowett, we wouldn't be talking about him getting the Chelsea job. And yet he did exactly the same as Lampard in the season before at Derby and getting them into the playoffs. So I think it's one of those things where reputation is the main factor, which I don't think is right. I think certainly I was having this discussion with a few friends last night just about who the best English manager is. And we kind of agreed that it was Graham Potter. But the idea of somebody like, you know, Graham Potter getting one of the sort of top six jobs, or even, you know, somewhere like Everton or something like that, is kind of, I would say, out of the question. And I think that isn't necessarily a fault of the English game. I think that's just the way that football has gone. But I feel like certainly, I don't really understand why in the past few years this trend has become so prevalent of going for these club legends. I think it is partly appeasing the fans. I think if you have a manager who plays a sort of an unattractive style of football, I mean, obviously, Stephen's mentioned with Solskjaer at United, you coming off the back of years of sort of abrasive attritional football under Van Gaal and Mourinho, and then to have Solskjaer and this whole sort of, I kind of think of it as a myth almost, this idea of, you know, playing the United way, and sort of there's a certain style to the winning that goes on. And I feel like this is the same thing with Lampard at Chelsea. It's this idea that, oh, he knows the club, but at the end of the day, he knows the club, and he knows that if he's not succeeding and he's not in the Champions League places, he's ultimately sort of got to keep one eye on the door. And I think it was a smart move from Abramovich. I think you have to look at the context of Lampard being hired. I think he couldn't really have gone anywhere else, because it was almost, you know, if he would have got in a big manager with the transfer ban and then it hadn't worked, it would have just been another manager he'd have had to pay off. Whereas I feel like Lampard is almost like sort of cannon fodder, because the fans are obviously going to give him more time because of who it is. And it was almost a free reign of kind of, you know, just do what you can with the team you've got and we'll see what happens. And obviously he did a lot better than I think most people were expecting. And then going into this season with all the money he spent, people are thinking, well, you know, how is he going to cope with it? And, you know, a couple of months later, we're sitting here discussing him being sat, which kind of gives you the answer to that.
Yeah, quite so. And you talked there about appeasing the fans. I do wonder what the players at some of these clubs think when a club legend with limited coaching knowledge or track record comes in. You know, players at that level are used to being coached within an inch of their life in terms of the tactical requirements and the demands and the, you know, intricate instructions for what should go on in a game. And then suddenly they're getting an ex-player who's popular with the fans, but maybe not so adept in all those tactical intricacies. I do always wonder what the players think at that stage, but I guess at the end of the day, you know, they need to perform regardless, but frequently there is a little upturn when they get a real coach in. But anyway, we'll go from the higher end of the Premier League down to the top half of the National League then. James, sticking with you for this, because this is your baby here. So Wrexham, been in the news in recent months, of course. Well, it's quite a few months now anyway. Their Hollywood takeover, which is still in progress, but I think just a couple of days ago, the financial, they had a financial sign-off anyway, which should progress things a little closer. I mean, you've had some involvement in all this, and without getting into all the nitty-gritty that I'm sure you can't divulge, the inner workings, but as somebody who's relatively close to what's going on, and as a Wrexham fan, of course, how's this all being viewed amongst Wrexham supporters, and what are their hopes going forward for the club, and what are your hopes?
I think certainly it's an exciting time. I think first and foremost, as a weird side note, not to bring this back to betting again, but since I've been involved with the Supporters Trust, I've not actually been allowed to place a bet on any football match, which is, you can kind of understand with Wrexham games and games in our league, but you know, I'm using the Bolivian second division here as a sort of a scapegoat. But
did you WhatsApp anything about the takeover though?
I didn't, not at all. But this is the thing. It's strange in the sense that you're not allowed to bet on any football anywhere in the world. But that's for another time. But in answer to your question, Aidan, I think it's, as I say, it's a very exciting time. It's an unknown time, both in terms of COVID and also with the two big Hollywood stars of Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney taking over Wrexham. Hopefully the deal, as the Supporters Trust announced on Friday, will be concluded in the coming week, and then it can finally be confirmed, because I feel like it's been, as you say, it's been going on forever. Certainly as a Wrexham fan, you look at it and think, well, when's this actually going to be completed? Because it would be nice to do something different after 13 seasons in non-league. I feel like it's one of those things whereby I think people have different expectations. Obviously, people are getting all excited, and you know, when they did their Zoom call, they were saying about how they never want us to play Chester again, which, if you're not aware, is our sort of big rivals, who are currently in the National League North, the league below us. They're sort of saying that they want to make us a global force. They want to make us the team for America, and all these sort of sweeping statements, which really, you could argue, are laughable, but at the same time, they do have sort of people in the know that they're in contact with. They have the funding, certainly, and in terms of as a club, there is certainly, I would argue, the potential there when you look at Wrexham's history and also the support base that we have, and the catchment area as well, in terms of being the only professional team in North Wales, and you know, in effect being the sort of de facto club of about 900,000 people in North and Mid Wales that live in the area. I think the main expectation really is obviously to get back to the Football League. I mean, as I say, we've been in the conference now since 2008, which is far too long, and at times we had some rather embarrassing defeats. One particular loss to Gateshead at home springs to mind. But I think in terms of the actual future, getting back into League Two is the main thing. And then most fans are saying that within 10 years, depending on how long they're sticking around, certainly the indications that we have are they are in it for the long haul, and they do want to really sort of build something in Wrexham. People are saying they would be sort of disappointed if within a decade we're not in the Championship. In terms of myself, I don't know if I'm, you can call me cynical, which is concerning because I'm only 23. God knows what I'll be like when I'm middle aged. But it's basically, I would be happy with just getting into League Two. That for me is, as I say, after sort of being in the conference since 2008, I just want to get back to the stage where we're playing teams that actually have a stadium, rather than just what is effectively a field with a few sheds on the side. You know, to be able to play teams that have a support base where you're getting more than, no disrespect to Boreham Wood, but you're getting 15 away fans for a league game when there's, you know, 5,000-6,000 home fans, and you end up losing. It's almost been years now of, I wouldn't say embarrassment, but I feel like it gets to the point where you kind of think, you look at the situation and the history, as I mentioned, of Wrexham, and and you think it would just be so nice to just be a competitive club that can, as I say, just be in League Two. I mean, my own personal expectations, let's say they're around for 10 years. If we're sort of a stable League One team with one stand behind the goal, the new cop stand bill, with, you know, a couple of cup runs here and there, I would take that. But as I say, that there are some people that have rather larger expectations, and if we're not sort of playing Premier League football by 2026, we'll be somewhat agitated.
You mentioned there 13 seasons since dropped out of the Football League. I hadn't realised it was that long. I mean, Wrexham is one of those clubs where, I guess, back in the days before, obviously I'm older than you, but back in the days before automatic promotion and relegation to non-league, you know, Wrexham were one of those clubs that were just in the league. You know, they were one of those that you always think, oh, League One or Two or whatever, or Division Three and Four, as it was called back then, of course. But 13 seasons out of the league is quite something. So yes, this is obviously the big chance to get back in there. But as you say, talk of leaping much higher straight away is a bit much. I mean, Matthew, over to you. I think you've got a question for James on all of this.
Yeah, for starters, as a Birmingham City fan with a basket case owner who we don't even know who owns us actually, I'm very jealous. And like the two incredibly likeable celebrities as celebrities go. But I find it very interesting that they seem very organised and everything, all their plans, like a lot of the plans, I know you said that they're making grand sweeping statements, but a lot of their plans seem quite like sensible. I don't know, like they're backing everything up. But I know there's rumours of, you know, they might be making like a Netflix series or like a documentary about it. Were there ever any concerns from like the sort of Wrexham fans that they were going to make like use Wrexham as like a figure of ridicule or something? I didn't know whether there were some concerns that like, who are these jokers, you know, coming to take us over? They're just going to like laugh at us and they're going to get the world laughing. Like I say, like, I think everything they've said is really sensible and they seem like they know what they're doing and they really care about the project. But were there ever any concerns of that from the fans?
There were a few, to be honest with you, Matthew. Yeah, I mean, when I say a few, I literally mean a few people. There were a few people who were saying, yeah, you know, they're obviously, there's an ulterior motive here. Why do they want to buy Wrexham? And why are they doing this if they're not going to be making money out of it? I mean, we've mentioned before about how money and football unfortunately go so hand in hand. And obviously you've seen recently with the sort of the Amazon series on several teams, and obviously Sunderland Till I Die on Netflix is a huge one. Sporting documentaries are really becoming a big thing now. It's a big industry, and obviously the idea of documenting, taking a sort of sleeping giant, as it were, that's someone else's words, not mine. I'm not that biased. But the idea of taking a club that is historically underperforming and, you know, going up the leagues and sort of documenting it, obviously does have a big appeal, and they've been very open. I think this is the nicest thing. Obviously, you say yourself as a Birmingham fan, you don't know who owns you. It's very nice that they could have said, oh, well, you know, we might do this. They've said, you know, I think the words that Rob McElhenney used was something like, why wouldn't we want to document this story? It seems that it's very much a case of they want to be a big part of taking the club forward. And I mean, in terms of the actual motivations for why they wanted to buy us, this is kind of stemmed in the idea that it was Rob McElhenney who really was driving it. And then he got Ryan Reynolds involved and kind of said, you know, is this something that could interest you? And then it kind of went from there. But it was mainly the idea that Rob McElhenney is a Philadelphia Eagles fan. And it's quite apt that we're recording this on the night of the Super Bowl. But he saw the Eagles win the Super Bowl and the sort of celebrations. And he said that to see that in Philadelphia, which is quite a working class area, and see how it brought people together, that kind of sparked something in him that he thought if he could do that somewhere else, that would really, really sort of make him happy. And he said that when he saw pictures of Wrexham and he saw the people in Wrexham, he said that even though he'd never been here, it almost, he felt like he knew the people in the sense of this sort of the working class background and the sort of slightly deprived sort of industrial state of the area, the fact that he could relate a lot to it. And I think that's the sort of thing that really reassured a lot of people, is that yes, they are going to document it, and undoubtedly there may be a few jokes at our expense, but I think given the transparency of the two potential owners, and also the fact that, as I say, we've been in non-league for so long, it's something that I think the vast majority of fans are more than happy to tolerate, if that is indeed the case.
Yeah, I mean, everything he said, everything they've said, sounded like very pure and very well-intentioned. And at the end of the day, even if there are jokes at Wrexham's expense, as if they get you up the divisions, who cares? You're still going to be successful.
Exactly. This is the thing. And I mean, we've had our fair share of dodgy owners in the past as well. I mean, we almost went bust in sort of 2003, 2004, when we had two guys try and asset strip us and basically evict us from the stadium to build a B&Q. So it's a case of, after that, you look at the two guys that are buying us now and you think, well, you know, we've had it far worse than two American, well, an American and a Canadian who are buying us with, you know, albeit a bizarre connection, but, you know, a connection at that.
Yeah. Well, again, excellent. I'm jealous.
Yeah, well, yeah, I know fine well who Newcastle's owner is, but doesn't make us happy about it. So wouldn't mind a bit of Hollywood glamour our way as well. Anyway, it's time to move on again and let our guests choose the topics now. So the chance to step up on soapbox and tell us all about any football theme of their choice, a rant or something to warm the heart, of course. So, Stephen, I'll come to you first.
Just like to comment once again on, I've mentioned his name once already on this podcast as a Man United fan, but the ground dog career that is Jose Mourinho, once again, coming to the surface.
Who could have predicted it,
eh? Yeah, I mean, but he'll get another big job, we know that. It might be slightly lower down than Spurs again, that seems to be the way. It's ever so slightly lower down the pecking order every time, but no doubt he'll go into that opening press conference with a big smile on his face, and he'll start off with 5 wins and a draw in his opening 6 games, and the press will be full of Jose, he's back, you know, he's the happy one, and all these sort of things. But for whatever reason, as we've known for a decade, 15 years, whatever it might be now, he simply has no plan B, and he cannot stand to lose. And I think them two things combined, as soon as things turn ugly for him, he starts asking players to do things that they're not comfortable with. I think he turns into a rather poisonous figure around the club, both behind the scenes and in front of the camera. And it just inevitably ends, and we said this at United, it got said at his second spell at Chelsea, it almost looks like he starts sabotaging the club so that he gets that bullet and he gets that payoff and he knows he'll get another big job. I've gone through spells of at last, whatever it is, since he came on scene. It's best part of 20 years now, isn't it? Where, like most people, had a lot of affection for him, really liked the guy. But it does seem like Jose Mourinho, unfortunately, has run its course, and it feels like he's just sucking things out of the game now and at whichever club he happens to be in charge of at the time. But we'll wait and see. Yeah, mark my words, it'll happen to another club. Would you take him at Newcastle, Aidan?
I was wondering if that question was going to come up. And compared to what we've got now, yeah, I would. it wouldn't last very long, as you say. But, you know, being slightly porous at the back is something he would sort out. To be honest, yeah, frankly, I would. But you're totally right in your general point overall. He is, his time has been and gone, it seems, doesn't it? And he hasn't moved with the times. And as you say, in any given situation, he doesn't have a plan B other than to cause it to go further wrong, sabotaging it, as the words you use there. It does come across that way, that he just wants to get out of there. So a little boost for a year or two and then it trails off is the familiar pattern. But frankly, I would take that at Newcastle for 2 years and then be back where we are. But no such luck, I don't think. Matthew, how about you?
Yeah, I just wanted to highlight what's happening in Spain, where they're having a quietly really interesting season. Atletico Madrid are absolutely storming the lead, the league, this year. They're on 50 points already. They've only played 19 games. They've only conceded 10 goals. They're 7 points ahead of Real Madrid, and again, 2 games in hand. What we're seeing, I think, might be a sign of things to come, because Barcelona are in free fall and are basically bankrupt. Messi, the whole Messi situation is getting more messy. El Mundo the other day, one of the big newspapers in Spain published, they got a leak of Messi's contract and sort of published the numbers, and the numbers were eye-watering. And now there's a sort of internal investigation as to who could possibly have published these contract details. It couldn't possibly have been the former president Bartomeu, who, you know, had a big public falling out with Messi, but that's kind of what the rumours are, I think. I think it's just turning into a really, really interesting season where you've got Barcelona in fourth, Sevilla, who have won, I think, seven straight, are in third. Real Madrid looking really old and looking really tired, just way off the pace. And Diego Simeone just working wonders with Atletico Madrid and just not giving teams a square inch to score goals. I mean, 10 goals conceded in 19 games is extraordinary. And I think, like I say, I think this may possibly be a sign of things to come, because Barcelona and Real Madrid are in freefall.
It's quite interesting, I guess, because we were talking just ahead of this pod about how in this league, anyway, in England, it's becoming a bit familiar at the very top again, at least, and at the very bottom, I suppose, in that the result that's come through while we've been recording, Man City have won 4-1 at Liverpool. So, you know, the chances of them running away with things, I guess, is relatively high now, although we did think that about Liverpool not too long ago as well, before their recent poor run. But that's still the two top teams of recent years are the ones that we're discussing going away with the league. Whereas in Spain, it's still staying in this more open format that maybe we thought COVID would cause across the board, or the lack of preparation that people have had this year. But in Spain, it's actually carrying on that way.
Yeah, it's true. And I think much like a few months ago, we were saying that Mourinho had mastered pandemic football. Obviously not right. Simeone seems to have just nailed it, and he's getting the performances. You know, they are regimented. They're like soldiers going into battle. They really are, like, drawing up the trenches. And yeah, just everything that's happening with Barcelona and Real Madrid is quietly interesting, and could see like a really big seismic change in Spain that coming over the next few years.
Excellent. Okay, then, James, and over to you.
Well, I mean, it's just a quick one from me, because I've prattled on endlessly about Wrexham. No, it's just about Ian Robin at Groningen. Obviously, he went there, so came out of retirement to play for his youth club, his boyhood club, and it's just such a shame to see how, obviously, the injuries that blighted his career have really just... they've just made it a hell of a homecoming. I mean, he's only played two games. One of those was off the bench, and the other one he had to come off within half an hour. He's not played since October, and he basically gave an interview yesterday saying that things... it was rather a sort of open-ended statement, saying that at the moment things are not going well. But it would appear that he's very much considering just calling it off and retiring, which is such a shame to see, because obviously at his peak, even with his injuries, he was a mesmerizing player. But it's just a shame that obviously this homecoming that he was supposed to do without fans as well, you know, it was the whole idea of just sort of playing for Groningen again with the fans receiving him and sort of welcoming him back to the stadium. But it would appear as if that is not going to be the case.
Yeah, that is a bit of a shame, I suppose, isn't it? Because it's nice to see big players, big names coming back to where it began, when it's, I don't want to be insulting, but a lower league or a lower standard, or not one of the top powers of European football, Groningen. Eredivisie isn't exactly a poor league at all, but Groningen is a step down, obviously, from where he spent much of his career. So it would have been nice, wouldn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Anyway, there is plenty of other stuff going on at these football times, as usual. Plans are afoot for the next magazine, and look out for the potential reprint of an old favourite alongside the next release. So make sure you keep your eyes peeled for that one. And on the podcast front, we've had some other interesting ones coming out recently, with conversations with BT Sports commentator Adam Summerton on commentating in the current situation, plus a fascinating chat with the Spurs legend Gary Mabbott on his career and his diabetes and how that's impacted. Plus there'll be a new series coming out this week as well. But we will wrap up there for today. All that remains is to thank my guests for making it such a good discussion as always. Matthew, thank you again.
Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. And Stephen, cheers to you too.
pleasure, Aidan, as ever. Thank you.
And thank you, James, especially for your Wrexham insight. That was very interesting.
Oh, well, I hope people didn't find it too sort of too boring. I do love talking about my Wrexham, but yeah, thanks very much, guys.
Excellent. And thank you to all our listeners too, of course, and I hope you catch us again next time. Cheers and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.